Welcome to America's Top Rebbetzins. In the merit of this class, may Hashem watch over all the Jewish people and give enormous strength to the IDF soldiers and hostages, including Hirsch ben Perelhana, Hirsch ben Rachel, Ido ben Kohava, Ilana Bey ben Yagina, and Inbar bat Ifat. Please click on the subscribe button to subscribe to us on the America's Top Rebbetzins YouTube page, or click follow to follow us on your podcasting app so that you are the first to know when an inspiring new episode is posted. Today, I am so happy to welcome Rebbetzin Dr. Hadassah Fromson. Rebbetzin Dr. Hadassah is a Yoatzer Halacha, counseling psychologist, and sex therapist. She grew up in Gibraltar, which I think is really cool, and she studied in Mechlala Jerusalem before completing her Bachelor of Science in University College of London and her PsyD in City University of London, where her research focused, where her research area focused on sexual satisfaction in the Orthodox Jewish community. Rebbetzin Dr. Hadassah is a sought-after college teacher, educator, and lecturer, and she regularly teaches about spirituality, halacha, intimacy, and psychology. Wow. Thank you so much for being here. Please tell us more about yourself and what you do.
So I think you summarized it very well. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you.
I grew up in Gibraltar till I was 17. So that's for people who don't know, that's the south of Spain. And there's a very small Jewish community there. When I was growing up there, there was about 600 Jews.
Wow.
So very small. In my Jewish girls' high school, there was like 24 of us in the entire school. So very small community.
Wow.
But it was amazing place to grow up. You know, things are quite calm there. There's a great quality of life. Very Sephardi, like literally from Sephard, right? My family is actually seven generations Gibraltarian on my father's
side.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because we have listeners to this podcast from Gibraltar.
Ah, there you go.
Yes.
So they will probably know me because it's such a small community that everyone does know each other. And then I moved to London when I was 17. I finished high school here. And then I went to Mechlala, as you said, and then I studied psychology and was involved in Jewish education. I met my husband. We lived in Cambridge for 6 months as we both finished our degree because that's where he was studying. And then we moved to Israel, which was like an amazing Shana Bet for us. And then we came back to London and, you know, started our family, and I did the doctorate. And then we also started working for a shul. So we're the community rabbi and Rebbetzin of a synagogue in Golders Green United Synagogue. We've been here about 9 years now, actually, which is amazing.
Wow. It's a lot. It's a long time. It's great.
It is a long time, yeah. And thank God. We're very blessed to do lots of meaningful things in our life, and we have four kids, and I guess I do a mix. Everything's connected, but like a few different streams. So psychology, I see people in therapy. One of the places I work for is Chana, which is an organization that supports couples going through fertility difficulties or just fertility issues, as well as sexual issues. Sometimes they're hand in hand, sometimes they're separate. And I see people privately, and I also do psychoeducation in schools or workshops about relationships, about sexual education, and just about in general connecting to other people, as well as doing my work in the community, which is about, again, like helping people with everything. I try to also talk about the Jewish angle and, you know, bridge the worlds of psychology and relationships with Torah and Torah ideas and Torah values, of which has so much wisdom to give us. And I feel very like all these different parts really inform each other.
They really, really do. And you know, your expertise, your background is really, really perfect for today's topic, because today we're going to be talking about a topic that so many parents find so uncomfortable. It's talking to your kids about sex. And even though this topic might feel embarrassing, it's really important that we do speak with our children about sex, because we want them to have the right information and also to be able to ask the questions that are on their minds. You know, it's better if we as parents are able to speak openly with our children about sex and about having sex, and to answer all their questions in an honest way. And this will help open up our channels of communication with our children and hopefully make them feel more comfortable with this topic. We also want them to feel like they can come to us whenever they have a question or a problem. But where do we start? That's really a challenge. Where do we start? Can you please talk to us about how we should begin talking to our kids about sex? At what age should we first speak with them about sex? And what do we say?
Yeah, so you made a lot of really important comments there. And I totally agree with you. I think your premise that you know, we want our kids to talk to us about sex is so fundamental. And sometimes I just want to, you know, talk about this a little bit because I think it's so important because we do feel at times, I mean, even I sometimes feel a bit awkward when I kind of have to bring up the conversation to my children because there is something very private about it. But at the same time, what really kind of keeps me saying like it's really important to keep talking and discussing about it is they're going to find out anyway at some point by someone. And I mean, everyone, depending on when you, where you send your children, sometimes you might send them to a really closed environment. Maybe there's not going to be access to internet or friends don't have access to movies. But you kind of, I think you have to think about what are they talking about in the playground? So when I did my study, so part of my doctoral research was it was a thesis that was looking at sexual satisfaction in the Jewish community. Yeah. And I was really interested in the role of sexual education and sexual knowledge initially on how it impacted sexual satisfaction. Happens to be other things came up that were more important about hashkafa and attitudes towards sex. But one of the things I asked people is, where did you first learn about sex? And for most people, it was not their parents.
Right.
And then the question is, where do you want your child to learn about sex from? Like, you know, it's not just a biological, mechanical thing, especially like from a religious point of view, sex is a deeply holy part of our lives. I mean, I was just telling some kids in a school this morning, if you think that every single person has a part of Hashem in them through the neshama, if you think about it, sex is the way Hashem has chosen to bring part of him into the world, like it's deeply holy. And if you never talk to your children about it, they're going to get their ethics and knowledge about sex from somewhere else, whether it's their friends, which, by the way, might be completely false. Like they literally just like make up the funniest things in the playground. Like you hear some of the stories of what they say, and sometimes it's completely inaccurate, but also they're getting information from. And then you think, where are the kids getting the information from? Are they watching movies? Are they overhearing adults talk? Are they learning from other people's what parents tell their children? In which case, by you not talking about it, what you're ensuring is that your child learns about sex and sexual ethics from someone else. And I think just like with everything in education with our children, you know, when we want our children to be good people, we want them to know not to steal, not to talk badly or treat badly with other people, how to manage their emotions. That's the biggest part of parenting. That's our job. We don't want to outsource that to anyone else because we want to pass on our morals and our values and our ethics. And I think something, for many reasons that people don't necessarily think about, is that by not talking about sex, there's two things. One is you are giving an ethic about it. You're saying this is something we don't talk about. It's not shaykh. It's not appropriate to talk about it. It's dirty, maybe it's embarrassing. Like you're giving an ethic about it, but also you're making sure that they're not going to get your ethic about it. They're going to get it from somewhere else. And maybe you'll wait till they're 16, but they already, I mean, I would say many children will know about something to do with sex, whether it's actual sex or whether it's just, you know, about bodies developing and changing, about from the age that they're eight, probably at the, I mean, eight might be late already. Because that's when, you know, children might start changing. So if you have one early bloomer in the class, right, and they start, their body starts changing, like that's going to be something. So you have to think about what are the kids going to be talking about in the playground? I think when you think about this question, right, saying like, what will they know and when will they know it by? And that's been a very important guiding principle for me. So you're asking, when do we talk to our kids? When should we start talking to them? So my philosophy is that having a big talk, the talk, for those who are listening, I'm like using my fingers for inverted commas, is not necessarily the best method. Like having more of a contextual way you discuss about things. Like when you don't sit down and tell your child right now, you really have to not hit other people. The education comes from the moment that they're babies, and like maybe they might hit you in the face, and you know, you show ow, or you say do nice, or right, you're teaching them values in a drip drip way, or in an appropriate scaffolding way, or in a building blocks way, or in putting pieces together way, that's happening throughout their life. And when you see violent, like let's say this, you see other children hitting each other, you might make a comment to your child like, oh, you know, it's really important not to hit, or like, aren't we lucky in our family? We don't hit, we use our words, or whatever it might be.
Right.
And I personally think that that's an easier way to talk about sex with kids. So, if you had the chance, like let's say you don't, you've got young children, is actually start talking about body parts and starting to use the right language already from a young age. I mean, even from, you need to think about what's your gut reaction when you have a baby. So, if a baby, you're changing a baby's nappy and then they touch their penis or vagina, what's your reaction? Do you push their hand away and say, "Ich yucky," or do you just put it away gently, and or do you let them just explore themselves a bit? There's clearly nothing sexual about a child touching their genitals when they're a baby. So what is your reaction, and where is that coming from, and who owns the issue at this stage, right? So education, I would say, permeates everything, like the way that you give messages to your children. And so there's no, at some point, obviously, you should sit down and like spell everything out, but it won't be like you're starting from scratch.
Right.
There is a whole history of education. The question is, are you consciously doing it or not consciously doing it? And sometimes it's our own hang-ups about and our own awkwardness, which is what you started with, right? This is such an awkward conversation to have that makes it difficult for us. So the first thing I would say of how education starts with your children is making sure you start thinking about being comfortable with it. So you reading up, you thinking about, how do I want to educate my child about sex? There's some great books. There was, I can't remember the title, but it's something like Everything You Were Afraid They'd Ask You About SEX. And it's a really old school book, but it's great. And it just starts making you think about all of these things I'm saying, like what messages are you giving to your children? And also realizing, that they're going to learn about it anyway, and you'd rather them learn about it the right way. Like, it's very common for kids to play doctors when they're little, right? Which is where they show each other their body parts. And hopefully, I mean, maybe something that would, that should preempt them being able to play like this is you having a conversation about what is appropriate to show and which body parts do we share with others and which body parts do we share with ourselves, and realizing that we are shaping their understanding of how they use their bodies. And it is confusing, because why can someone touch my arm but they can't touch my vagina? Like, what makes it different?
Right.
And so when you're saying when should we talk to kids about sex, I would say it's a contextual conversation, but it very much depends on you being aware of it. Like, you being aware that when you do say things like this, you are giving them sex education, whether you intend to or not.
Right. And so when, like, so let's say like the child is a little bit older now, let's say 9, 10, 11, 12, maybe, and you really, you want to spell it out. Like you said, you want to sit down with them and have like an actual conversation. And it's going to be, it's going to be an awkward conversation, but you're right. If you start earlier, you're not starting from scratch. You're starting based on all of the teachings that you've been doing since maybe they were born or since they were like a toddler. But how do you, okay, so maybe let me rephrase a little bit. What do you say? How much do you share? How much information do you share? What exactly do you say to them?
Okay, so let's say you've not really, you have a child and you're thinking like, wow, I really need to talk to them about this. So first of all, yes, better to do it now than when they're 15 or 16. It will definitely get harder. In this book I'm recommending, I remember it was describing it in such a funny way. It said that, describing the sexual act to a child before they're sexual is kind of similar to saying you put your nose in someone else's mouth and blow. Like, just disgusting, gross. And I feel like in some ways that's so much easier to explain it to them before there's all their own self-conscious sexual awareness, right? Which for girls is probably around 8 or 9. So I wouldn't sit down and like kind of, if you've never talked to them about it before. So the way the education I've done, which I think works, but you know what? My oldest is 10, and I'll have to tell you in 10 years time if I was right or wrong. Like, it's all like, I don't know if what I'm doing is the right way to do it. It makes sense to me. I learn from like when I'm seeing working with teenagers, or I work with young adults, what goes wrong for them, and I'm trying to figure it out. But like, it's all just me trying. I'll have to tell you how all these methods work in the future. But we start off talking about, maybe the different body parts, and then natural curiosity. They say, oh, why do we have different body parts? And you might say, well, boys have sperm in their bodies and girls have eggs in their bodies. And to make a baby, you need to have a sperm needs to meet an egg. Okay, that's one stage. So I think of it as scaffolding, or like giving them pieces of a puzzle and like letting them put it together, which I think makes it easier for you and for children. The next stage would be is like, oh, where do the sperm and egg meet? It's like, oh, they meet inside the woman's body. And then the next stage might be, well, how do you know? Eventually, your child might click together, and they might ask a question like, how does it get in there? And then you have to say, oh, the man has to put his penis inside the vagina. And then they might leave it at that, or you might explain it more depending on who you are. I find pregnancy is quite if you're in a family where you're still becoming pregnant, or there's an aunt, or there's someone who's pregnant, it's a very good time to talk about it. Something very important for kids to know also is like, where do babies come out? And then when you say they come out of the vagina, like you can make comments like, yeah, that's how they got in. Like it's kind of making little comments to give like almost clues to the child. But it's very important that it's not, if you're embarrassed by something, you bring that across. And I know that's really hard to say, because people, if they feel awkward, it's very hard to not feel awkward. But the more that you practice it in your head ahead of time, or the more you read about scripted conversations in books about how it goes, the more you can anticipate it. But fundamentally, you need to spell it out. And once you need to talk about it at some point, you need to say it. I think doing it in a drip drip is the easiest and best way. But I would also say, sometimes your child vessel might know a lot more than what you think they do. Like you might be ready, like gearing yourself up to have this talk, and you might say, you know how babies are made, and they actually know everything already. So number one, or they might have it all wrong, or they might be asking you a question like, where do babies come from? And they just meant like, the hospital, and you just started giving them the whole sex talk. One of the things I would do before you go into your whole conversation is say, well, what do you think? Or what do you know? Or what's your guess? And that's also, anyways, just a great question to give to kids when they ask you big stuff, even if it's like big theology stuff, big stuff about God. That's all their answers are precious. And like you sometimes they're real gems of insight. But also it helps you gauge where they're at, and understand like what information you need to go towards. And it's really important to use medical terminology. I think that's important, because first of all, they need to know that knowledge. If you want them to be a person who can look after themselves, go to the doctor, describe things themselves, you need to give them the language in order to be able to describe it. Also, I strongly believe like the best way to keep our kids safe from, like, God forbid, terrible things happening to them, is giving them the awareness and tools and understanding. And if you think about the harm that's caused by them not knowing versus them knowing, I think it's no question. Like, telling them, this is a vagina, and nobody's allowed to touch, your private parts without your permission. And the only people that, you do that are your parents if they're helping you for a medical reason, or a doctor for a medical reason. But other than that, this is a very special part of your body that you share with someone when you're married. Then they have the tools to know that if someone tries to like convince them to do something, like they know that that's wrong from the outset, as opposed to not being aware of it or being clueless because no one told them about it. So I also think, just from, never mind about giving them great education, but just keeping them safe, it's an important concept, is to give them use medical terminology. Also makes it less embarrassing. Also, I think what's so important when it comes to sex education is teaching your child how to talk about it in a respectful way, right? So the worst is if like they either can't talk about it with any words at all because they don't have the vocab, or they use very dirty words or perverse words. And actually what you want to teach them is, this is such a special, holy part of your body. Let's treat it with the respect it deserves. Like, this is the ability to make another person. Like, what an incredible part of your body. Let's protect it. Let's treat it with respect, which is fundamentally what we do in Judaism. But they won't know that if we don't talk about it. There's a very famous Gemara in Brachot. I mean, some people love this, some people hate it. Personally, I love it. It's a story. It talks about a rabbi called Rav Kahana, who basically went into his teacher's bedroom. His teacher was called Rav, and he basically heard him being intimate with his wife. And it says he heard him chatting and laughing with his wife, and doing all sorts of things. And he pops out of the bed and says, Rav, like, it sounds like you've never had such a eaten a cooked dish or a tasty dish, which is a euphemism saying like it sounds like you've never been intimate before. Why are you so like, you're so into this and you're just reveling in it. What's going on? And Rav appropriately says, Rav Kahana, what are you doing here? Like, get out of my bedroom, get out of my room. And Rav Kahana responds, it is Torah and I must learn it. So Torah v'lilmod ani tzarich. And I find this a really fascinating source because one, it tells us that learning about how to have sex is actually is part of the Torah. Like if you think about it, I always get quite upset when people kind of skip over all the parts to talk about sexual things in the Torah. Because I personally, my view is like, it's not on us to censor the Torah. Like if Hashem wanted this, if you believe that Torah is min Hashemayim and it's pure, like if Hashem wants this in the Torah, it is beautiful and pure. And if you think it's not holy and pure, that's your misconception, not a problem with the Torah. And I know it, like it's very common in schools for children not to talk about the story of Yehuda and Tamar or to talk about the rape of Dinah. But it's also extremely relevant because these are things that happen. I mean, when we were talking about the rape of Dina, I think I remember it was shortly after the October 7th massacre. And you thought, how does the Torah deal with rape? Like, what to what point do we allow things to happen? And it's like, well, the Torah is teaching us a story here. And it's telling us what to do and deal with it. And, if we're not choosing to get those tools from the Torah itself, we're the ones that are missing out. We're the ones walking blind, and not giving our kids the tools. And obviously everything needs to be done age appropriately, but if the Torah wants to talk about it, it's because there's sexual ethics that we need to be learning about it. It is Torah. And in Torah and in Nach and in Gemara, it's full of talking about, I mean, that's not all what it is, but there is plenty of instances where it talks about sexual ethics. So first of all, it is Torah. This is what Rav Kahana is saying, is Torah. I have to learn it just like everything else. But the other thing, which is the sub thing that's sub conversation here is why did he obviously did something very inappropriate. He entered his teacher's personal space and private space, right? But he did that because it wasn't taught to him in the Bet Midrash, and the place where he should have been learning about it wasn't taught to him. Therefore he had to go to this extreme circumstance in order to learn about it. And that's what we see that happens with kids. If we don't talk about it, they're going to find about it one way or another. Their bodies are changing, their hormones are raging. Like, what do we expect for them to all go through all these bodily changes and not talk to anyone about it, not find anything about it? For boys, it can be very hard having all of these hormones running through their body. You need to teach them how to manage it. And if you don't, then they'll resort to things like pornography. If your child has access to internet, we are in an epidemic of porn usage. It's like, it's crazy how many people are completely addicted to it, how much it's impacting their relationships, and it's so easily accessible. And the problem is that this is a new phenomena. Like, we've never had such access to porn ever before because of the way that the internet and technology is developing. You could just be at a friend's house and they can just have a phone and they can just be run into the bedroom and in 5 minutes they can. It's completely different as opposed to like when we were younger, like it would take forever for things to load on the internet. Like it's a completely different situation now.
Yes.
And if you're not aware of it, if you're not actively managing it, it's going to happen somehow. And I think the point is that you want your kids to learn about sex and all the ethics associated with it in the right way. And if you don't, they will find it either way.
Right. It's so true. And I totally agree with that. But, and I like that, you're using medical terminology and you're being honest and you're being open with your kids, when you're talking about sex and you're describing the process and you're also teaching them to respect their body and their bodies are holy. I think this is all, part and parcel of the package. But the question is, how much do you tell them? Because you don't want to tell them too much and you also don't want to tell them too little. So, like, how do you know?
Yeah, so I think as a general rule, when it comes to what does it mean talking too much is really when you start talking about yourself, so your experiences. So I would say that is a boundary that is important to keep up in general. Like when you're speaking to, you shouldn't be sharing anything that happens in your bedroom unless there's a problem that you need help or fixing with. Like that's something that's private. That it's important that you don't talk about that with other people. And I think for a child parent boundary sake also, they don't want to be thinking about what you're doing and you don't want to be worried that they're thinking about what you're doing. And that's very important. And I would never use, I do this and I think that and I feel this and this is what we do. Like, keep yourself out of it. But I would say The thing is, when you say you don't want to tell them too much, like again, if you don't tell them and they're curious, they're going to find out about it regardless. Maybe you could tell them, you know what, I don't feel comfortable about it. Let's look up some information together, or I'm not sure. But I think, you know, there is age appropriateness. Like you don't need to sit down with them at 9 and tell them about all the things in the world that are going on. You do probably want to start and open the conversation, but I do think that there's something important to think about when your child asks you something and you're like, wait, why do you know that? That's too much. You shouldn't know that. When you respond being like, you know, it's not appropriate for you to know, what is it that you're telling them? You're telling them, you can't talk to me, I won't answer you. Or if you give them an answer that's either not true or very basic, all they learn is my mother or my father won't tell me the truth. Like, oh, rolling eyes. You can just imagine rolling eyes. My parents, yeah, they don't think I know anything. And like that you have to think, like, what's the consequence of you not telling them? And fundamentally, they're curious. I mean, and again, I just want people to, not to scare people, but like kids know and talk about a lot more than they think. And me, and it depends what school they're in. But like I've done, you know, sex ed for kids who are age 10, 11, like leaving primary school. I don't know the equivalent in America, how the schooling system works. But I've been like, I have been quite taken aback by some of the questions and surprised. And for me, that's even more so a reason to be honest, because if these are the questions that they have and they're thinking about, I really want them to ask me. I really want to make sure that I'm the person that answers their question and not someone else, and that they don't go on Google and look up the answer to their question, because that's a whole other, you know, crazy world out there of what they could find. So in terms of like too much, I don't know if there is a too much, if they're asking. I wouldn't kind of offload all of it onto them, but what I was saying a bit in the beginning about responding to their question. So, you know, say something and say, what do you think about that? Have you ever thought about that before? What are your friends saying? Like, you know, or I mean, another great thing, and I was always in dilemma about this, is what books you let your child read. Okay, on the one hand, we want to protect them. And like, we think, you know, if we give them inappropriate books that, you know, books that talk about relationships, maybe that will get ideas in their head. But this is stuff like that they have to learn between the age of 8 and 18 or 19. They have to learn it somehow, right? So if you give them the book and say, you know, I'd love to discuss this chapter with you, or like, where are you at, or what do you think about this? That's a way of engaging in a conversation with them about a relationship, a topic. And being able to engage with them with it at the same time, it's also important to know, if a kid's not ready to hear about something, it goes over their head. Like, they can read about relationship stuff going on and maybe even parts of intimacy. And if they don't understand, if they're not in a place where they're going to be able to get it, it just will go over their head. So you can also feel a bit secure in the fact that I think a child will only conceptually like kind of understand something when they're ready. You can even tell them something, and I've done it like once or twice. I've talked to my kid and I realized, I think it was like the concept of death, right? Like a death, when you talk to them when they're 4 or 5, it's quite a big concept. It's quite scary, right? And like, I know like once talking to them about it, and literally like the next question showed me they hadn't taken in anything I'd said. Like, children are very resilient like that, and they will block things out that don't make sense to them or that they're not ready to understand. So I think, you know, we also don't have to be too neurotic about it.
You know, and that makes sense. I really like that, because the children themselves, you'll get cues from them as to whether they're ready, what they're ready to hear, how much they're ready to hear. And I think that's really, really important. You know, it's so interesting because I have a friend, a very close friend. She's also a sex therapist. And she said to me, you know what? She has 3 girls. I want them to come to me and ask me all the questions, no matter how disgusting it is. I want them to ask me. It was so funny the way she phrased it. Like, she's like, I want them to ask me like the dirtiest questions, because I want to be the one to respond to them. So it's very, very interesting. You know, I don't know what they were asking her. I didn't ask that information. You know, I don't even think I want to know, you know, but the fact that she said that, you know, it made me open my eyes to say, wow, you know, maybe I should be having more honest conversations with my kids, but also, you know, in response to what they want to know. They, you know, they may have their own questions that are different than my friend's kids' questions, you know? But that's kind of like what I was thinking, how much is too much? But if they're asking about it, it's not too much, because they already know about it. Maybe they've heard about it from their friends. So that's a good cue.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about how, you know, talking about, you know, you have to respect a child for being another person. I think the hardest thing as a parent is realizing our children grow up and have their, they will go on their own way and they'll be their own individual. And you want them to make good decisions, but I don't think it's enough for someone to, for your child to do something just because you say so. I mean, definitely, maybe I'm doing something. My kids, they very much, what works for them is when they understand, when they buy into the rationale, they're more likely to do it. So I often will, like, you know, kind of follow the logic along the line. So I'll say, we don't do this because of this, and if you do this because of that, until we get to a logic or a rationale that they also agree with.
Right.
And I, like, for example, things like if we want our children to be shomer hanagia, right? So like not touching the other sex before they're married. You know, sometimes you just assume they will be because they like grow up in the culture. But if you never actually sit down and talk to them about it and say, why is it important? You know, what happens when people can get carried away by lust, and how does it work, right? You're just missing an opportunity, I think, on getting them to really own the mitzvah. Like in general, personally, I think in Judaism, it's important that we don't just do stuff because it says so, but like we understand, like, how does this make me a better person? Like, what is it teaching me about a value here? And please God, we want our children to also have that, but they won't have that unless you tell that to them. Like, they're not just gonna, you know, take, especially because they're not talking about it in school. I promise you that. Like, if you don't feel comfortable enough talking to your children about sex, the teachers are also not going to feel comfortable talking to your children about sex. So they're not getting it from anywhere.
Right, right. Their friends, their peers, who also may just be just as uninformed as they are, or maybe tell them information, maybe they're more informed, tell them information that you don't want them to know, or in a way that you don't want them to have it.
Yeah, also, like, again, like, we live in a different age. Like, everything is, like, any piece of knowledge and information is accessible within 2 seconds, within less than 2 seconds. Like, it's just a fact of life, and you just have to agree to that. And at some point, like, even if you don't let your children go on the computer, at some point they're going to have access to the internet. Like, at some point they're going to have to research a paper of something for homework, right? Like, you know, and you kind of, I think it's better, wiser to give them the tools to know not why they shouldn't be looking up for certain things, or they're not feeling a need to look up for certain things, and helping them understand why and what's the repercussions and how does it impact it. You know, like, we have a debate a lot with our children at the moment about having a phone, having their own phone. So one of the things that we do, I mean, it might be a bit intense, is I was like, oh, look at this article that recently came out from like the Children's Commissioner of England. Like, look, it says like, oh, they think that phones are so damaging for young teens, and that people, and that there's a whole discussion, maybe they shouldn't let kids have certain access to certain things before the age of 16. And I let her read those articles and say, look, it's a debate that's happening, because I wanted to have that, you know, for at the, some point she'll need a phone, because just for safety reasons, just for getting around. But I wanted to realize already, having the discussion about like, what is, like, phones can be harmful, what is harmful about social media, so that when we get to that stage, there's already been a lot of education and learning about it.
Right. And speaking of the social media, this is a great point to ask you. You know, I'm curious how parents handle the mixed messages that kids might be receiving from social media, from television, from their friends, or even some of them have school health education classes. Maybe in some schools they have that. You know, if your household philosophy is different from what kids are hearing outside of the home, you know, from whomever they're hearing it, that could be very confusing. So how can parents handle this issue?
Got to talk about it. you just have to sit down and, you know, say, and also you have to recognize your child is going to be hopefully an independently thinking person.
Yes.
And they might disagree with you.
Yes.
That's a really hard pill to swallow as a parent.
Yes.
Right? But the best thing, and we kind of almost assume our children will adopt our views on life, but that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
I remember someone, it felt so freeing actually when I was like pregnant with my first, and I was like, oh, I just hope that I do right by my child. They're like, you know what? At the end of the day, they are who they are. You just have to give them the right, you know, soil and the right water and the sunlight to make them be the best that they are. But fundamentally, they are who they are. And that's the same with religion as well. Like, you can do the most, whatever you can to educate, but they, you want, I mean, for me, it's a success if my child independently comes to a conclusion about something. Like, they've thought it through and this is their thought, and it might be different to mine, and I might disagree with it, but I would, I mean, again, I don't know. I'm still dealing with young children. I'm hoping that it'll be okay, easier to deal with the fact that I know that they've come to it thinking about it from all angles, and they've made a decision that in to them makes sense. So when it comes to like talking again about your values, and it could be either way, right? Like, maybe a school has a much stricter view or a much more conservative view than what you think, or vice versa, or it's much more liberal. or progressive than what you think at home, you know, talk about it and also explain why you have your values. Now, this is the tricky bit, because sometimes we ourselves don't know why we do things. So this comes up a lot when I speak to people, when they say, you know, about, you know, let's say, for example, they send their kid to a school, and in the school they learn on Shabbat, you know, you don't drive cars, you don't use electricity. And this is can be hard for families who want to have a lifestyle where they like they keep a Friday, you know, they do have Friday night meal and then they go to shul, but they do also use the car and to get to shul or to other things and use money. And then they're like, but how do I explain to my child like that we're not doing something bad? I don't want them to think like, I don't want them to disagree with their teacher, but I also, you know, don't want them to think we're doing anything bad. I'm like, well, can you explain to your child why you do this and don't do that? And sometimes they can't. It's like, they're like, I don't know. Like, well, the first thing you have to do is be able to explain, have some sort of reason why you do stuff and don't do stuff, what you do believe and don't believe. And then you can pass that on to your children. But I think many times we ourselves haven't really thought about it. And so it's very hard to give over a message you haven't thought about. And it's also very hard for your child to subscribe to a message that there's no rationale, logic, or reason of why they should, you know, of why you do what you do, apart from do it because I say so, which personally is not my favorite parenting, you know, go-to. So I would say have a conversation, discuss it, make sure your place is a place where you're open, and also preempt things and say, you know, I'm aware that we have different ideas from the school and I really respect, you know, everything the school does, because the last thing you want is for your child to go into school and say, well, my parents think differently and cause all that ruckus. You know, we respect, but it's also okay to have different views. And when we're in the school environment, we think in one way, you know, you act in one way, but when we're home, this is what we do, why we do. So it's having that openness.
I like that. I really, really like that, because that's reality. That's the realistic way, you know?
Yeah. And also you want your child to be able to integrate in the world around them, and yeah, in the world around them, not everyone's going to agree, and it's not going to be a homogenous environment. And nope. And even if you do live in a homogenous environment and you think, you know what, my child is always going to interact with people that are similar to them, guess what? One day they'll grow up and they might have to move somewhere, and they won't. And then what's going to happen? The only thing that will happen is they won't have the skills to know how to navigate it.
Right.
Right. That's all that it's that you, because you have until 18 to give them the skills that they need for life to survive. Right.
Right.
And you've got to cram it all in until then. And hopefully you'll have a connection with them after, so they'll still seek advice from you. But really, and when I say 18, by the time they're 16, the time they're 15, they're kind of off doing their own things. So how many years do you have to actually give your child the guidance and the guiding principles?
Right. Right. So it's not as many as we think. And this is the truth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when it comes to actually speaking to your children about sex, so is it better if the mom talks to the girls and the father talks to the boys? And I mean, what if you have a single mom or even a single dad?
So I think that's a really good question. In general, I'd say, I think that would feel more comfortable for everyone, but also more in sharing your experience. So, you know, I can definitely empathize more with my daughter, you know, when, if she complains about, you know, when the time comes that about period pains or, you know, I can also understand her more, like, how much does my, you know, my husband doesn't understand my emotional state, you know, never mind being able to, we've already said, like, I'm dealing with all the teenage girl drama and he's dealing with all the teenage boy drama, because like, we just don't understand the other.
Right.
And that's okay. And that's fine. And that's normal. And so I think there's something about you being able to understand what your child's going through and relate to that and help guide them through it. But that's not to say that it can't be done by the other parent if for whatever reason that parent can't. So this is particularly relevant, as you mentioned, to single parents. You know, you want them to talk to you about the big stuff. At the end of the day, you're limited by the limitations of your body and what you can really empathize with and know. You know, I'm a sex therapist, but there is only so much I will be able to understand about male sexuality compared to female. Like, it just won't be a firsthand experience. And it's also okay to say you don't know and get help and have some, you know, show some vulnerability and say, you know what, let's look it up together, or let's research together, or maybe I can find someone who can speak to you about this. You don't have to do it all alone. But I think what you do need to show is you can be a person they can talk to about stuff. And I guess what helps children feel they can talk to you is you not being judgmental. So one is not forcing it on them, because you have that stereotypical parent that wants to have all the openness in the world, and they try to like really overshare, and then they kind of lose that boundary. They want to be more like friends, and the child's rolling their eyes like, no, I just want you to be my parent. And the boundaries are important and the roles are important to maintain. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to, I think that the thing that, if you think about it, what stops stops kids from speaking to their parents, you know, and it's really hard for us to go back. What stopped us from speaking to our parents? It's hard to draw back from like 15, 20 years ago, but it probably was feeling like they didn't understand me, or they jumped to conclusions, or, you know, they thought badly of me as a result. So it's kind of trying to hold back from doing all that and recognizing, you know, it's almost going back to the thing of like, you know, you are an independent person and I'm just going to give you the things you need to have to flourish. I'm not going to try and prune you or change your direction. Like, you are what you are. And I've just got to, you know, give you the guidance for it. And hopefully the right soil, right? And the right pesticides, you know, to keep away bad stuff. But fundamentally, you are who you are. And I think when you come from that point, realizing that they're this individual worthy of respect, it can change the way that you relate to them.
I really like that. Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of times parents have the view, this is my child. It's, I mean, and yes, children are an extension of their parents, but they're not their parents. It's hard sometimes for parents to understand that the child is their own individual person, you know, and not just a little mini me, you know?
Yeah. And I think sometimes that's more about, you know, seeing them transition between being a little kid to a big kid, but also think about how similar are you to your parents, right? So when you flip it around, it's like, are you exactly the same as your parents?
No.
Maybe in some cases, but chances are you're not. Chances are you're quite different.
Yes.
And maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah, that's funny. It's true. But, you know, we were talking so much about focusing on how we speak about, you know, to our kids. But I want to focus for a moment on how our kids might be feeling when we talk to them, like from the kids' point of view. You know, as uncomfortable as we might be feeling as parents, being the ones to initiate the conversation on sex, or even if our kids initiate the conversation on sex, it's, you know, it could be a little bit awkward for us parents.
100%.
You know, but our kids might also be just as uncomfortable in receiving the information. So, you know, we want to help our kids feel more comfortable talking about the subject, and we don't want to make it so taboo. So the more at ease they are, the more receptive they will be to hearing what we have to say, and the more open they will be to asking us more questions. So how can we help our kids feel more comfortable when it comes to engaging them in a conversation about sex?
Okay, so I think firstly, it's, you know, if you have this philosophy of doing drip, drip, it's nothing's a big shock. But look, even, okay, my daughter also, like, you know, sometimes I'm like, I have to sit and talk to you about this. And she's like, oh, please, we have to have this conversation again. Right. So I clearly don't have all the answers. But sometimes I don't push her in the awkwardness because I feel like, well, why should I be making her sit through an awkward conversation? But if it's something that's really, really important, right, I say, look, I know you don't want to talk about it. I know it's awkward. Okay, sometimes things are just awkward. I have to tell you about this because, and I give the logic and rationale. I say, because I need you to know this before you go and do this, or I need you to know this before you learn about this in school. I need you to know this before you hang out with this, you know, friend or whatever it is. And I explain my reason why. And sometimes that's where the parent boundary comes in, right? We don't have to keep our kids. Our job, I think, very important. Our job is not to keep our children safe, in a safety bubble from everything, and just be like, anything bad, any bad emotion, like, try and protect them from, right? Again, you're not giving them resilience or skills for life. Like, you need to help. You need to help them be okay with awkward, difficult feelings. And, you know, if it's very important for you to give a message over to your child, you have to put them down and sit and listen. And like, whether it's go for ice cream or whether it's say like, you know, we'll go do that. I really appreciate you listening. And like, you know, obviously you can make it nice, you can make it easier, but it's okay to assert whilst you still have it, some sort of parental authority and boundary in order to like do what you think is, you know, giving an important life, you know, life skill. When it comes to sex and relationships, I mean, this is probably the single most thing that impacts people's happiness for the rest of their life, right? Whether they can manage, be in a good relationship or not.
Yeah.
Is probably the most important thing you can give your child. So, you know, it's like the same as giving them first aid or teaching them to swim. Like, sometimes you just have to do it. Your child doesn't like to swim, and you say, oh, honey, I know it feels so difficult. Okay, you don't have to go in the water ever again. No, it's not realistic, right? It's a mitzvah. You have to teach your child to swim, because if they're ever in danger, they'll know how to save themselves. So it's okay for your child to feel uncomfortable sometimes. How can you make it better? It depends on your child, but partly it's by this not being a, you know, a big talk conversation, but rather a drip drip feed. Part of it is also like, you know, just calling it out for what it is. Okay, I have to talk to you about something awkward right now. Make sure that you're in a private space. Make sure that no one can overhear you so they don't feel more awkward. And also ask, you know, check in with them. Say, how are you feeling right now? This is really awkward. Make a joke out of it. You know, if they really kind of don't say, look, it's so important to me. What can I ask them? What can I do? I really need to talk to you about this. It's really important I give you this information. What can I do to make you more comfortable? So again, turning them really into another person that you're talking to, with, not talking at.
That's very important. That's very, very key. Thank you. Thank you. We have time for one last question, but I think it's a very important one. So as girls, as young girls become teenagers, as they mature, they're quite often faced with peer pressure at some point when it comes to sex. You know, so I wanted to see how you can make sure that they have the right tools to make the right decisions and get out of situations that might make them feel really uncomfortable.
Oh, such a good question. Okay. So important. I guess part of this is being able to talk to them. I think preempting and pre-planning situations can be very helpful. So, you know, if you know, and again, this is something that can happen throughout a child's life. You know, what would you do if you were being, your friend was being mean to you? Or like, how would you manage that? And talk them through a scenario. So again, like if you know it's something they are going through or you're worried that it's something you could have, you could say like, you know, what are your thoughts? How would you manage this situation? Or you could bring up like a case scenario, say like, oh, I have my friend's daughter is going through this. What do you suggest? What do you advise? Because I think when people have a chance to think things through before it actually happens, then they almost have like a response they can go to,
yes.
Right? They can understand how to feel. And this is something that I find really effective just in general life and in when I'm working therapeutically, like helping people. If they know they're kind of getting into sticky situations again and again, let's say a couple, they keep fighting about something. Say, okay, you're going on a big trip together, right? And you're going to be stuck on a plane for 12 hours, right? How are you going to manage that stressful situation? Like the baby's crying, you're both exhausted, it's an overnight flight, right? And you think, okay, well, what are all the different points you can do? Where could you go? How could you, what are the words that you'll tell each other? You know, let's come up with a tactic. Like if you're feeling uncomfortable, you can miss call me twice and I'll know to come pick you up, or I'll say you have an emergency, or maybe you can make a deal with a friend that if you both feel uncomfortable, you kind of go do your own thing, or maybe don't go. And I think kind of, again, treating them very much like, what would you do? How do you want to handle this? And then also giving ideas, but pre-planning situations can help with peer pressure and reminding your, you know, I think also you as a parent remembering and reminding your daughter, like at this stage in their life, peer pressure is a very big deal. It's not something, you know, the worst thing a parent can say is like, you know, if your friends would jump off a bridge, would you follow them? Because like the way that the teenage brain is like, yeah, maybe they will.
Right.
Right. So that's not a good logic. Also, like the way that their brain's developing, like they do very much strongly care about social belonging.
Yes.
And they're very bad at risk analysis. So
yes.
Being aware that they do think differently to you. So you might have to help them do a bit of the thinking and the long-term consequences and understanding that and spelling it out for them. I also find the idea of like learning from others' mistakes important. So, you know, we have no shortage in the world of like movies and stories and books of girls who are peer pressured and went wrong. And like, maybe you could sit down and watch a movie together and say like, what would you have done differently? And what do you think about that? And take these scenarios and situations and analyze them and help your child like that possibly.
That is really helpful. And that's very practical also. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you so much, Robertson, Dr. Hadassah, for joining us on America's Top Robertsons. And in the merit of this class, may Hashem watch over all the Jewish people and give enormous strength to the idea of soldiers and hostages, including Hirsch ben Perel Hana, Hirsch ben Rachel, Ido ben Kohava, Ilana bat Yagina, and Inbar bat Yifat. Thank you so much again.
Amen. Thank you.